When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So I had a bat where I got rung up. This guy just threw me a nasty curveball, like just buckled my knees big time. I was like, oh, I started taking one step back to the dugout, and the umpire goes, ball. And I was like, sweet. And the catcher goes, where was that? And the umpire goes, I'm not going to lie to you, I didn't see it.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today's episode is with Blake Alemán, an infielder who was a fifth-round pick of Texas A&M by the Brewers in the 2015 draft, who recently retired after topping out in AAA in their system. I've been looking forward to this episode for a while. When I was a senior in high school, our center fielder went down with an injury pretty early in the season, and we plugged in a small but talented sophomore to take his place. That guy was Blake, and he spent the next 10-plus years exceeding expectations. From sophomore plug-in to high school star, walk-on at his dream school to a four-year starter, and a senior signed on a discount to a guy playing in AAA. This conversation with Blake really dives into making the most out of your talent, with some fun stories about playing in big SEC games and trying to grind out life as a utility guy in the minors. I'm really thankful that Blake took the time. Join me. Hope everyone enjoys the conversation. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. We're over 50. They're all pretty evergreen. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Tell us what you think of the show. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. We have finally reached Omaha. We've got our field of eight set. Teddy and Joe covering that on the BA College pod, and great stuff on the other pods. Future Projection with Carlos and Ben is back, and the 90th percentile. A lot of good stuff. Always a good time to be subscribed to BA. And with that, let's talk to Blake Alemán. All right, joining in for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm, he was a fifth-round pick of the Brewers in the 2015 draft out of Texas A&M University. One of my former high school teammates, Blake Alemán. Blake, how are you doing today?
Doing good. Excited to be on the show.
I'm excited to have you, man. Long time coming. Congratulations on you gave it hell out there. You've recently retired, joined the coaching ranks, joined the rest of us just being old. Want to jump right into it. I know, knowing you from a pretty young age, you've always had aspirations to play in college. You had to play exactly where you ended up playing. When did you first realize that you were actually going to have a shot at that level?
Honestly, probably not until my sophomore year of high school. Like I said, since I was 5 years old, both my parents are A&M grads, and I used to grow up going to those games. It's brainwashed from birth, as people like to say.
You grew up in the cult, man.
Yeah, brainwashed from birth. So I always had the dream to play at A&M from the time I could watch a game at A&M. So that was kind of my goal. And then, I worked hard. I was never the biggest guy, as you would probably remember. And then I kind of had, a mini growth spurt as a sophomore to get to a whopping 5'5", 130 pounds. And I started actually having some success. I went to a camp and, they seemed somewhat intrigued, I guess. I was like, okay, so this is might be a long shot, but could be a possibility. That was kind of the first glimpse. I was like, okay, maybe a little bit more work and this is possible.
I mean, to touch on your sophomore year, was my senior high school. You could say, you plugged a spot during that year. You filled in center field when a guy went down. And then I think you ended up taking over at shortstop, arguably kind of saved our year in that regard. But yeah, you were a small guy. I can say that as a fellow, very small guy. Your dad is not big. Your parents are not big. So it wasn't like there was going to be a lot more height coming forward. You kind of knew that in early age. What did you put in high school to keep the belief that you'd be able to play beyond high school? And what kind of skills were you working at? Did you know you needed to do to accomplish what you weren't going to have in certain physical gifts?
Yeah. So like you said, my dad always says, you can't pick your parents. It's kind of a joke. So I knew it wasn't going to be very big.
He's an athletic dude, though. I do want to give your dad credit.
As you look around, the landscape of baseball, just growing up, there's plenty of smaller guys that can still perform. So I knew there was a possibility. I just had to find my skill set, how to make that work. So at the plate, I thought I had pretty good power for my size. That was my goal. I may not have a lot of power in terms of, I guess, compared to other people, but I'm going to have as most power as I could possibly have for my body weight. If I use my body correctly to get as much out of this body as I can. And then defensively, my arm, I wouldn't say was weak. It wasn't like a can either. So I didn't know that. And you have to play the positions a little differently and cutting certain balls off in the infield and have to play the balls a little differently. So it's all doable. You just have to kind of know yourself. And that's kind of something I think I've tried to do is be very self-aware in what I am as a player and what my strengths are. And, you know, and also what my weaknesses are. And you use that to kind of find your way into being the best player you can be based on your skill set.
We've had switch hitters on this show before, but I think you're the first that picked it up in high school. Walk me through that process, why you decided to try to make the jump into switch hitting and how long it took to really feel comfortable. You're a natural righty. How long did it take to feel comfortable to step in the lefty batter's box and feel 100%?
Yeah. So actually I didn't do it in games really until late, but I worked on since about 12 years old. I was actually at Burnie High School hitting with my dad when I was 12. We were picking balls up after one of the buckets, and I just threw a ball in there on the tee left-handed and whacked it like jacking around. And my dad goes, "Oh man, that was pretty good. Do that again." And like just happened 2 weeks later, my good family friends, they had a big ranch in South Texas, and right across the street from Chipper Jones's old family ranch. And so we got to go hit over there in Chipper Jones's batting cage with Chipper's dad, Larry. And then my dad basically goes, "Hey Larry, I like to take a look at my son's left-hand swing. Let me know if it's worth pursuing or not. You have an idea of what a good switcher looks like, since Chipper is one of the best of all time." And he goes, "Yeah, man, it looks good. How long have you been doing this?" He goes, "Like 2 weeks." He goes, "Oh yeah, that's really good. It's natural." So that was kind of green light. So from that point on, every time I'd go hit with my dad, we'd mix in like maybe one bucket left-handed, just kind of jacking around. And I would do it in some games in like little league or trial ball when we got up by a lot or something. And then my dad really wanted me to do it in high school, but I didn't want to because obviously I was a smaller guy. So I was a lot weaker left-handed. So I'd make a lot of solid contact, which wouldn't go very far. Being left-handed, it was kind of weaker side. Took a little while of the strength to get there. And then right-handed, I know I had a lot more hand-eye coordination and natural power. So I just was very, I guess I would get frustrated if I would go hit left-handed and not get a hit. And I was like, man, I would crush that ball right-handed. What am I doing over here left-handed? So that progressed. Again, I was dead set hitting right-handed all through high school. And then I went to an A&M camp my junior year, and they started kind of unofficially recruiting me a little bit. And then the last day of BP, I told them I could hit left-handed. They go, "Let me see it." And I, at that point, I guess I had not hit left-handed in probably about 2 years. So the growth spurt and strength that I had, I guess my left hand swing, the ball started jumping a little bit. And I happened to hit like unbelievable in this dead arm BP at A&M left-handed. And they go, "Hey, so that looks really good. We'd like you to keep doing that. So we're recruiting you, but if you come here, we would like you to switch it." So that was kind of like, well, if they're going to want me to switch it, I need to start doing it. And then, so the junior year after, this is kind of funny. The junior year after that camp, I was like, "All right, I'll try switch hitting." I told Chuck Foster, our head coach, "I'm going to try switch hitting to start the year." I started this year off 3-for-13 left-handed, and I got like super annoyed. I was like, "Dude, this is stupid. I could be getting raking right-handed." So I told Chuck, "I'm bailing out. I'm just getting right-handed." And he goes, "All right." And I told my dad that. My dad was all upset with me. But then I proceeded to go 19 for the next 23 right-handed. So I was like, yeah, I don't think I'd be hitting left-handed anymore. So I did that right-handed all the way through. And then I ended up committing to A&M after my junior year. And so my senior year of high school, I was like, well, I'm already committed to A&M anyways. Might as well, you know, do it for a year. I guess because of the fact that I knew where I was going, I was relaxed or whatever it was. Ended up having an unbelievable year hitting left-handed in my senior year of high school. And it just kind of went from there. But yeah, to answer your original question of how long it took to get comfortable, I don't think until I was like maybe in double A where I was like, all right, I feel better left-handed than I do right-handed. That's how long it took probably. So before that, I was always kind of like, man, I'm grinding left-handed, but throw me the bat right-handed. I'll go up there and I feel more comfortable. But probably took to about my first year in double A till I finally was like, man, I feel better left-handed than I do right-handed. So it took a little while.
That's like 6-7 years of baseball.
Yeah.
In general. That's a lot longer than I thought it was going to be. So you mentioned you commit to A&M after your junior year. In that junior and senior year, here in the San Antonio area where we grew up, you're all area. You're the Express News Player of the Year, which is our paper here for folks who don't know. It's, you know, the guy who's usually the player of the year gets in our area a lot of times gets draft attention, gets a lot of recruiting attention. The guy my senior year got drafted, the guy after you, Ralph Garza, he's pitching the big leagues a little bit this year. You had that early commitment. Did you get the kind of attention from other schools anywhere else that tried to pry you or tried to reach out, or were you just so laser focused on A&M that there was really no other colleges coming to call or that you would show interest in?
Yeah, I mean, I think a little bit of both. So I kind of blossomed a little later. Like I said, I didn't do the big, you know, travel ball circuit where I went to these showcases. So I would like to think that my sophomore year coming popping on the scene, I was pretty unknown commodity in terms of college recruiters. Basically, I joke, I pretty much recruited myself there. You know, I went to four camps. They only saw me play outside of camp twice. I had some people talking to me, you know, small schools, UTSA, obviously, local school, and then some other mid-majors. And Baylor was, you know, talking to me a little bit. But like I said, it's a lifelong dream to be an Aggie. So as soon as they even offered anything, I was actually preferred walk-on. So once they offered me a spot on the team, I was like, yeah, I'm in. So did that and didn't really, you know, and I had a huge senior year, which I think if I had been uncommitted at that point, I think I'd have a lot bigger offers coming in my way. But at that point, I was already committed to A&M. It's where I wanted to go. It's where I always wanted to go. So I wasn't too concerned about it. But I think it was more of a perfect storm of me going to the school I've always wanted to go to. And I didn't really have a ton of success till kind of later on. So at that point, it was kind of already was out of place. And all the good numbers, everything I put up was kind of like late. So the offers didn't really roll in until after I was already committed.
Before you got on campus, like you had put up these big numbers your junior and senior years, but you're still a walk-on, you're still a preferred walk-on. The team that you're going into, A&M, you know, at that time, Big 12 school, about to be an SEC school, guys drafted every year, on that team, especially multiple big leaguers and the team that you were going to come into. How did you feel about yourself as a player, your chances of contributing early, contributing at all before you got to College Station?
Yeah. So I'm pretty confident in myself, my abilities. I've always had to be, with my size, but that was like probably one of the only times in my life. I remember I was going in there pretty hesitant. I'm like, ooh, I'm kind of nervous. Like we got Tyler Naquin come up with All-American right fielder. I'm like a walk-up, Ross Stripling, all these big leaders. I'm like, man, this is so. It was a little eye-opening because like I knew I could play in terms of my class. I got to play with some other guys I was going into my recruiting class with in the summer. Helped me on there. Okay, I'd like to compete with my freshman class, but that's one other animal. These guys are junior, seniors, and 21, 22-year-old grown men who've already put up All-American years at college. So I was a little shell-shocked going in there. And then on top of that, I got moved to third base. And my freshman fall, I've never played third in my entire life. And, you know, I like to pride myself being a utility player, but third base is a little different than second and short in terms of ground balls. Balls coming at you hot.
I was about to say, do you remember the first rocket you ever got hit
at? It was the first inning of the first inter squad. A guy named Matt Yingle, who ended up playing AAA with the Marlins. I'm playing double play depth, like even with the bag. He hits a one hop rocket off my forearm, off my chest, ricochets into the stands. And I was just sitting there stunned, like, what just happened? So, yeah, that was eye-opening for sure. And then my first ever inter-squad at-bat was off Michael Wacha. I punched down three pitches. And then my dad called me after the first day. He said, hey, man, how'd it go? I was like, well, not good. I was like, I don't know if every pitcher I face is like that, but if they are, I'm not sure I can hit this level. It was pretty eye-opening. But it turns out that Michael Wacha is pretty phenomenal. Made a lot of hitters look stupid. So, it got a little easier after that. But, yeah, my freshman fall was really bad. I think I hit about 100. In 40 at-bats, I made probably about 8 or 9 errors. I was just mentally kind of just sped up, overwhelmed, did not go well. My exit meeting in the fall, yeah, they basically said, like, hey, that was not good. We'll see how the first couple weeks in the spring go. We have more inter-squads. If it doesn't get any better, we're probably going to ask you to go to junior college and try to come back next year because I don't think you're ready to play at this level right now. So that was eye-opening. Went home for Christmas break and, you know, had like kind of a look-in-the-mirror moment, like, reflecting on why I was so poor. And I kind of came to my realization. I go, that was on me just being nervous, making it bigger than what it is. I don't think anything that they did was I wasn't good enough to do it. I was just like, I guess so nervous to be on that stage with those guys. So I try to go back in the spring, like, okay, you played this game your whole life. It's the same game. Mound's still 60 feet away. First base is 90 feet away. It's just the same game. It's not a big deal. Try to calm down, just be who I was and end up having a phenomenal 2-week spring scrimmage deal. Work my way into staying at A&M. And then
that was the first goal was just trying to stay. Like, when did you find out you were actually going to be able to stay and they weren't going to ship you to, I assume, Blinn?
Yeah. So yeah, I told me I was going to stay after probably right on the going into our last weekend of inter squads. They're like, hey, We're going to keep you here. We're not sure if we're in a red shirt year or not yet, but you're going to stay here. And I was like, all right, cool. So then my next goal became, I just want to try not to get redshirted, see if I can get any type of playing time at all. And so we were having, you know, I keep working, I keep just doing really well in practices and stuff. And sixth game, we're playing the second weekend of the season, we're playing Holy Cross, and we're beating them, you know, pretty bad. And it's like the eighth inning. Well, all of a sudden, I'm not even paying attention. I'm like, I'm enjoying it, being a freshman. Like, this is awesome. We're Olsen, we're kicking someone's butt. This is great. And then, like, the eighth inning, Coach Childress was like, hey, hold on, get a bat. You're pinch hitting. I was like, oh. So then, you know, I'm like, oh, crap. Now it's real. I'm about to get my first at bat. And I get out there. End up, I think I struck out looking after a foul, like four or five pitches. And I was like, ah, all right. So first bat, okay, whatever. At least I got in the game. Wasn't expecting anything after that. Our second baseman at the time, I've been struggling offensively for the first couple of games. And he's a great guy. He's one of my better friends now. He's an awesome teammate, one of the best guys I've ever played with. So on Sunday morning, I never was playing, but I always come check the lineup to see the what BP group I was in and all that. Just, you know, just a habit. You check the lineup. So I went down there and checked the lineup about 8:30 a.m. on a Sunday game when I'm starting at second base, batting nine hole. I'm like, oh, my God. So I was just came out of nowhere. Text my dad, like, hey, I'm starting. He goes, what? I go, yeah, I'm starting. He goes, all right. So he got all excited, and I was pretty excited. I came out of nowhere. I did not expect to start within that fast based on how my fall had gone. It's credit to Coach Childress, which I always respected. He always says we're preferred walk-ons. Well, when you're on the field, you're in campus, you're the same as a scholarship guy. We're treat you all the same, and you perform, you'll play. So he did tell his word when it came to that. So I appreciate him. You know, he did that with multiple guys. Ross Stripling was a preferred walk-on. I'm not sure you know that. So we had a lot of really good players that preferred walk-ons. But anyways, so I get to dug out, I'm about to go off the first pitch, whatever. And Coach Shrills told me, like, he goes, hey, nervous? I go, no, sir, I'm excited. He's like, all right, well, just don't let me ever take you out of lineup. That's your goal. Make me play you. And that was very motivational to me. I was like, all right, so just go in there, do your job. And the first at bat, I got up there, I got asked to sack bunt, drop down a really good sack bunt, look up, no one's covering first. So I got my first college hit was a sack bunt that no one covered first on. Next at bat, he's got on first base, two outs, end up lacing a line drive to left field. Guy goes first, third. Next guy drives him in. That was, you know, a big run, like in the fifth. And we were kind of, you know, it was 5-3, kind of sputtering. And then we end up, you know, running both after that. I get taken out for defense substitution, like, late in the game. So that was kind of my first game. Then I played every game the rest of our freshman year because after that game, kept performing until I got mono and missed the Big 12 tournament and the regionals. But until that point, I played every game. So it's pretty incredible how fast it all kind of went from being counted out, about to be asked to leave, to maybe not register, to, oh, you're in the game, and then take advantage of it and roll with it.
How many starts make you a starter? Like, how many times do you have to play in a row to be like, okay, I'm when I check the lineup, I'm going to be in there?
Man, with that team, how deep we were, some vision players, I never felt safe, to be honest with you. I was like, okay, I've had a good 2-week stretch, but, you know, maybe two bad games in a row, I could kick a week break here, because – he was known to change the lineup a lot unless you, like, just one of the dudes. So, I mean, that whole freshman year, I really never felt safe until he got to probably, I don't know, May. And I, at that point, been playing pretty consistently for about a month and a half. But, yeah, man, I just never took it for granted. I was so grateful to be playing that much as a freshman. And I believed I could do it, but the amount of success I had that fast was surprising to myself anyways. So, I mean, it was a pretty cool experience, and especially the turnaround I had from the fall from being almost – asked to leave to being the freshman that made the most starts of anyone in the freshman class. So it's pretty crazy to how the turnaround happened.
We talked about the baseball adjustment, but I, as the first person on the show who went to A&M, I need to ask, what are you guys seem to have to learn a lot as far as how to conduct yourselves in the football stands and become the arguably to outsiders, the most annoying fan base in college, the loudest and most annoying. How much work goes into the midnight yell stuff, learning all the chants? How much do athletes participate in that?
So for normal students, they have this thing called Fish Camp, which is for all freshmen, incoming freshmen, the first week before school starts. And it's like they have group leaders, they sign in different groups. And they basically take you through all the traditions at A&M and like taking your hat off in the bookstore because of the memorial and paying tribute to the veterans, the yells and the games or this tradition here. Like there's a, like all these little things, like there's a statue, you put a penny on for good luck for a test and stuff, like all these little, you know, kind of quirky things. And you know, I get it's culty from the outside, but man, growing up in it and being a part of it, once you're a part of it, right? And I'm sure you'd ask many other Aggies, even some that were not growing up, but we had teammates from Florida and Oregon that would come and they thought it was the coolest thing ever. So, I mean, it's really quirky and it can be culty, but man, when you're a part of it and then they're the ones backing you up as the fan base and being a part of it on football game days, it's a really cool experience, but there's a lot that goes into it. And I get some of it is a little quirky myself. I'm like, yeah, okay, that's a little weird, but it's awesome to be a part of. And yeah, just kind of take you through all that stuff. But as athletes, you have the option to have like an athlete only fish camp, or you kind of just like pick it up as you go. I mean, I actually end up telling my teammates a lot of stuff because I grew up knowing about all of it. Like, hey, what's that? So I tell them like, okay. So I actually did a little bit of, you know, coaching, I guess, on how, what certain things meant and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's cool. It's a lot. And there's still some stuff today that they're doing now that's new that I don't even know. I'm like, okay, I don't know what that is. I have to ask someone. So it just keeps ever evolving, I think.
We're recording this after Supers, A&M, obviously on the way to Omaha, at time of recording. We saw the past 2 weekends, that crowd is always loud. It's always, you know, Olsen Field or Blue Bell, always packed. As a freshman, and even as you're older, is it more nerve-wracking taking at bats at that ballpark, even though it's your home fans, when they're always loud? There's always a ton of people there. There's you got the students, you got the diehards, you got the message board folks just going hard, or is it more nerve-wracking in a way hostile environment?
For me, I think it was, I never got super nervous, but it's a little more tense because you want to please the home fans, man. You want to give them something to go crazy about. For me, I love playing on the road and embracing that because I love all my favorite things in the world is to, you know, have a big hit in Alex's box and have the whole stadium just go silent. Like, I love just being kind of a villain in the sense of being the guy on the road in this hostile environment and doing something really big to, you know, beat that team or push ahead to where the whole stadium just kind of sits on their hands for a little bit. I just love doing that. So I never got super nervous on the road. I took it as a challenge. I thought it was very exciting. I love being in those environments. At home, same thing, man. It's just, you feel this need. You have to, you know, have so much success and win these games, and you want it so bad to do it in front of your home fans. So I guess that's where nerves comes in a little bit. You just want it so bad to almost try to do too much at times. But yeah, man, it's an awesome environment. I was actually there last weekend when they beat Louisiana in the regional, and it's awesome to see how packed it's getting. And I think they have plans to maybe expand soon, and the fans were awesome. The Ball Five chants were rocking, and the bubbles were going, which is, I don't know if you know, but that the bubble is something that my team, my senior year in college, we actually started that. Now it's like a thing. So that's pretty cool to see that still going. But yeah, it was pretty cool, man, to see what they can do in Omaha. I'm actually heading to Omaha Saturday, so I might get to watch them play. I could have a chance to watch A&M Texas in Omaha. That'd be pretty incredible.
Oh, that's going to be a bloodbath. So after your freshman year, you guys make the move to the SEC. Obviously, the A&M football team that fall makes a big-time impression on the SEC, one man in particular. You guys making that switch, suddenly your conference schedule, you're not playing Texas in conference anymore, all those other teams, you know, you're moving. Was there a big noticeable difference in environment, in gameplay, in anything, or was it just, hey, new schedule, let's go try to win a different conference?
Yeah, I mean, we were told, I didn't recognize anything different until you get into it, in the midst of it, obviously. So the first thing that jumps out is the facilities in the SEC, the stadiums are just, their way, they care a little more, I think, about baseball than some of the Big 12 schools. Now, some Big 12 schools have unbelievable facilities, but top to bottom, the SEC, they pack out 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people, you know, great facilities, like a lot of almost minor league park type stadiums are awesome. So that was the first thing, that just every place you go is nice with a lot of fans. That was awesome. The second thing is just the depth, really. That's the one thing I noticed. I try to tell people that, like when they say, what's the difference between the SEC and Big 12? It's not the fact that the best teams in the Big 12 are any worse than the best teams in the SEC. It's the worst teams. Like every week in the SEC is just like, that team's good. You don't play good, they're going to beat you. Like in the Big 12, no, I mean, there was a few teams there when I was in that year that, no offense, you show up, you're probably going to win 2 out of 3. They're just not very competitive. Like for instance, my senior year, they're Tennessee, ironically enough, who just, you know, had a rough weekend. They finished last in the conference when I was a senior. And they finished 14th in the conference, didn't make the SEC tournament. And I think they had 6 players drafted off that team. I think 4 of them in the big leagues. So, like, that's the talent on the worst team. And it's just kind of you got the worst place team, the Sunday Stars, still pumping 92 out of the pen. Like, that doesn't happen a whole lot in the Big 12 when you get past like the top three or four teams. So it's just more of the grind. I know they say that and it's cliche, but it really is. Like, there's just no breaks. Every week in the SC is like, okay, another series, we got to step it up, or we don't play well, we're going to lose. So that's the biggest jump I saw. But the top tier teams, Big 12, are just as talented, just as good as the top tier in SEC. It's just kind of the 1 through 14. There's not really huge gaps. So that was, it drained you a little bit, you know, having to have that kind of effort and that kind of, you know, mental, yeah, focus every weekend. It's draining. It's a grind for sure. So that's kind of the biggest thing I noticed.
That sophomore and junior year, you're doing the utility role thing. You have starts at third, second, shortstop. Did you feel better at a certain spot? Like, do you walk into a game day, see where you're slotted, and suddenly feel better or worse about how you're going to play based on where it's at?
I always feel more comfortable playing middle infield, short and second. I still, this day, I've played a lot of third now in my life. I still don't love third. I mean, it's still a grind. I'm over there. I'm like, okay, we got to grind this way through here. Just doing things stupid over here today. Try to make all the routine plays. But I don't ever really feel comfortable over there. But no, I don't think I ever felt my day was going to go better or worse. It just kind of changed my mindset. Like, I'm playing, you know, second. I'm like, okay, I felt a little more at ease, a little more comfortable. At third, I'm like, okay, I got to try to, you know, start thinking through, okay, I got to try to play this ball this way. Or certain balls that at third base gave me trouble. So I was like, okay, I'm going to play that ball today. And but as long as I was in the lineup, be able to hit and being part of the game, I was always pretty excited. But yeah, I mean, it's utility role, something you have to carry all through pro ball too. It just kind of, you know, it is what it is, and you have to accept that's the position you're playing that day, and you got to make the best of it. So if I'm going to play third base that day, I'm going to try to be the best third base I can be that day. So that's kind of the mindset I took on going forward, my utility role.
Playing at A&M, especially starting at A&M, affords you the opportunity for some good chances at playing summer ball, good places to go. I know after your freshman year, summer, you at least signed with the team in the Texas Collegiate League. But how, especially in those early years, did you go about making the best use of your summer and summer ball time?
My freshman year, freshman summer, I was going to go play in Louisiana and Texas League. I actually got mono the last week of the season in the Big 12 tournament going to the regionals. And with that, I lost, I think, 15 pounds. And so I had put on about 15 to 20 when I got out of high school freshman year, which I didn't have a whole lot to put on anyways. And I lost all that back. And so they kind of mutually said, hey, you're coming off that mono, you lost a lot of weight. I want you to just stay here in College Station and like lift with our strength coach, put on weight, get stronger, kind of more take care of your body instead of your game. So I did that, ended up putting on like 20 pounds. And then my sophomore summer, I actually did go play in the California Collegiate League. So I went to California. That was a lot of fun. I played in San Luis Obispo, where Cal Poly's at. Got to play against Santa Barbara and other teams. That was a lot of fun. So sophomore summer, I actually went out there and played. So that was a good time. But the freshman summer staying here was more so about just trying to get my body back and getting weight on and trying to, you know, improve that part of my game, because that was kind of things they thought was holding me back a little bit, how, I guess, smaller I was and losing that weight after that sickness. So I had to try to beef up a little bit.
And then walk me through that summer after junior year, the Cape experience. Talent level is as good as anywhere. Talent level can, you know, compete with an SEC weekend. What is game intensity like?
Yeah, man, that was strange. Because obviously you hear about the Cape, all your, you know, Cape's the best, you know, all these players. And going up there, I was super excited. Didn't know what to expect. And yeah, the players were unbelievable. I saw so many good arms, just guys pumping. But it was a very weird environment because the stadium up there, like, bad high school fields. The grass is like 6 inches long. I hit a ball in the gap that like the ball landed and stopped, and like didn't roll because the grass was so long. Like, it's wild. And then the fields are terrible, lights terrible, umpires are local high school umpires, so they're funny, man. So I had a bat where I got rung up. This guy just threw me a nasty curveball, like just buckled my knees big time. I was like, oh, I started taking one step back to the dugout, and the umpire goes, ball. And I was like, sweet. And the catcher goes, where was that? And the umpire goes, I'm not going to lie to you, I didn't see it. So, like, they didn't. Another guy, like, missed a call again. And this guy's pumping 98. And the umpire, and the catcher's getting on. I'm like, where's that at? And then the umpire was like, man, I'm sorry. I'm trying here. I've never seen anything harder than 88 in my life. Okay. I'm trying my best here. So that's like what we were dealing with. So it's kind of funny. But the Cape itself wasn't kind of what I expect in terms of, like, I didn't realize how wooded Cape Cod was. There's trees everywhere. And then the beaches were very rocky and cold. And I'm like deathly afraid of sharks. And that's where Jaws is based out of. So my butt wouldn't get in the water anywhere. So, but it was a good time. My teammates, they were awesome. I actually shared a room at a host house in twin beds with Harrison Bader, who's the center fielder for the Cardinals now. He's my roommate. We shared beds. I could reach over and touch his bed. So I could spend the whole summer in the same room as him. I had other big leaders on that team. Richie Martin, who played shortstop for the Orioles a little bit last year. Brett Sullivan, I think he signed a big league deal with the Brewers and got traded to the Padres. I've had a couple other, you know, guys on those teams, but yeah, it was a cool experience playing as other players. The talent level in that league is incredible. And it was so cool. Just, you go take BP and there's 15 scouts there for BP to watch, you know, in some backfield Cape League game. They're all out there, watch take BP and throw around the diamond stuff. So it was a really cool experience. And to say I was able to do that, it was pretty awesome.
With those scouts, you're heading into your senior year, suddenly you become a more attractive draft prospect in terms of just senior sign. You get, you know, if you put up a good year, you can save someone some money and be a, be a productive player. When you're hitting in front of the scouts in the Cape, are there, you know, how do you kind of stay within yourself and not try to, you know, juice up a couple little balls and hit some extra BP home runs and stuff like that? Like, how do you keep calm in front of scouts?
You know, I guess it's cliche, but I try to think they're there. Just, you know, you go back to your normal BP routine and you be yourself and do what you got to do. I mean, you don't try to get out of who you are. Cause that's when I learned from the failures and experience in the past that every time I try to be someone I'm not or do more than I'm capable of, I usually tend to have not go very well. So through those experiences, it's like, okay, whenever you get in some kind of a situation where you're a little nervous, whatever, just be yourself, do what you do. And kind of let that take care of itself, and like your game will speak for itself. Don't do anything more or anything less. Just, you know, kind of be who you are. So I just try to have a good BP, good professional BP, spray the ball with the yard, you know, barrel balls up, run off the rounds, whatever they were, oppo hitting or whatever, you know, run off the rounds and try to do that, and, you know, show that I was able to play the game a little bit and be professional. So that's kind of the approach I took, because again, it goes back to the whole self-awareness thing where I knew I'm not a home run hitter. I don't go and crush balls on BP, especially where I hit off over the lights or anything. So I'll show off my skill set, which is my ability to handle the bat, spray line drives, you know, be a complete hitter. So I kind of took that approach to my BPs.
When you got back to campus that fall of 2014, do you remember when you first learned about the new lower seam baseballs or when you started hitting this?
Yeah, they told us that when we got back that they were changing the balls to the minor league balls. That was apparently supposed to go a little further, which would they think they did. So, but that was awesome. I think I like the way they feel better too, just throw them around, and obviously anything as a hitter that let the ball go further, I'm all for. So, we play with those in the fall a little bit. I did notice a little bit of difference, but then by the time it was the spring rolled around, you almost forgot they were new ball. It just kind of just played the game. But yeah, I think it did help juice up some of the offense in college baseball in general a little bit going into that 2015 season.
Yeah, well, you had gone into that year with one home run. You know, your senior year, you're putting up numbers, you're hitting home runs, you're taking Carson Fulmer deep twice. I know at that point you're in the middle of a postseason run, but bringing it back to the draft question, you played in front of those scouts in the Cape that summer. The draft is close now. By the time you get to the postseason of your senior year, it's pretty much cemented. You have put up a good senior year. You have a great shot of getting drafted. Do conversations happen? Do you talk with an advisor? Do you talk with your parents? Do you talk with scouts? Like, how do you kind of balance, we want to go try to win a national title with, I would like to get drafted?
Yeah. So obviously playing professional baseball was like my golden, you know, I could even pick up a baseball bat. So that was, you know, the fact that it was that close and that I knew it was a real possibility. Like at that point, like I said, by the time we were regional, super regionals, it wasn't the fact that if I was going to get drafted, it's more of like when. And for how much, so that I knew that was a real possibility. So I knew that was kind of already there. I wasn't really super concerned with it at the time because being a senior, being my last kind of college go around, and at that time we were having a great year and winning a lot. All my focus was in winning and trying to go to Omaha. So I put all the eggs in that basket, and I'd worry about the draft later. But yeah, during the meantime, you have meetings with scouts to come in. You have to fill out some questionnaires, and you know, they kind of get your take on what we're looking for as a senior, like how much are you willing to take, or you want to go in the top round, save money, like kind of just get your take on things. And I didn't have an agent or an advisor at that point in time. So I was kind of doing all my own, just filling my parents along as I went. Really, I was pretty new to the whole process. I'd never been drafted before. So just kind of answering their questions and basically saying, yeah, for everything I've been told, I'm going to get drafted. Just kind of a matter of when and how much I'll be able to get as a senior. So, and then we had that run in the regionals and then super regionals, that last game where we lost in the 17th inning, that game ended about 2:30 a.m. And then we drove back to College Station. I got back about 6:37 a.m. I got about 2 hours of sleep, woke up to a phone call from a Brewer scout at 9:30 in the morning and asked me, say, hey, this is Brian Sankey with the Brewers. He's like, we're looking to draft you today. He's kind of curious on what you're looking for money-wise, what you would take. And off of that, and worked it out. And then like the next hour or so, I was drafted. So it's kind of crazy. We're going from losing 17 innings to go to Omaha to being drafted within literally like 6 hours.
How do you figure out what you would take? Like when it comes down to that, because they're obviously looking to go under slot so they can pay someone else. Like, how do you come up with the value? And is there any thought in your mind of just saying, I'll take whatever you can give me?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's kind of basically what I said. I go, hey, I'm not stupid. I know I'm a senior. I know this stuff works. Like, I don't have a whole lot of leverage here. So I go, no offense, I'll take the most you can possibly give me. I don't know what that is, but I obviously want the most I can get. But like, I don't know what that is to you. But yeah. So he threw out a number. He goes, we take that. I go, yeah, absolutely, I'll do that. He goes, okay. So it's pretty funny. So they had to get permission. He goes, are you sure you're going to take that? So I don't have a problem, you know, talking about it. So my slot was $348,000 in the fifth round. And I ended up signing for $40,000. And so he threw out, he's like, hey, will you sign for $40,000? And I was like, yeah. All I've been hearing was like, you know, 10 grand, maybe if you're lucky. He didn't tell me what round though. So he's like, hey, we're going to draft you soon. Like, will you sign for 40? I was like, yeah, that sounds great. I've never heard anything that high at all. And so, he said, well, I need your parents to, like, you know, A-okay that you're just talking on your butt. He's like, if I draft you and you don't sign for that, I'm going to get fired. I was like, no, I go, no, sir. I'll sign. I got it. He's like, all right. So, and then sure enough, literally like two picks later, he drafts me in the fifth round. I looked at my dad, I go, well, crap. And it was the fifth round. I might have asked for a little more. But so it was like, super exciting though. This is the fifth round draft pick. It was pretty cool. And it was an exciting day to, you know, see that your dreams are being fulfilled. And the crazy thing about the draft is, too, I signed for $40,000. I still think I was the third highest paid senior in the entire draft. So it's pretty crazy how the seniors sign stuff works. But, yeah, it was a really awesome experience. Like I said, whirlwind, because literally 8 hours prior, I was ending my college career at 2 a.m. on a walk-off in 17th inning. So it's pretty nuts how that all kind of just flipped in a matter of a couple hours.
Yeah, it's a pretty nuts play at the end of that super regional, if anyone wants to versus TCU in Lupton. But yeah, I gotta imagine the getting drafted part is a pretty big pick me up. But how far does 40,000 go in over, you know, a 7 year professional career?
Well, I'm a pretty frugal, so I actually have never touched it. So I still have all of it. I've tried my best to use everything else I have, given private lessons or my paychecks in the minors, and scratch as much as I can. So it's gone a long ways for me, because I didn't have any big expenditures in terms of, I didn't really buy a car or anything. So it's lasted me a long time. Fortunately, it's been a nice little kind of, I guess, safety net for whenever my next step in life comes, I have a little bit of a cushion to help something. So it stretched me a little bit. So it's been nice to have, for sure.
Well, you go from playing in the super regionals, to the, to Helena, to short season. How those, especially those early years, short season, low A, high A, the difference in lifestyle between life at Texas A&M an SEC school, a well-funded SEC school, the difference in travel, the difference in diet. You mentioned the weight you put on. I'd imagine a lot of that was muscle when you got to college because of what you guys can do there. So the diet, the housing, that adjustment process, was that you mentioned frugality. I mean, that's, minor league is a great place to be frugal, but how did you adjust mentally and physically to the difference in lifestyle?
Yeah, it was pretty different. So getting off the plane and Helena, Montana, I was like, first of all, I've never been to Montana, and it's beautiful up there, but you feel like you're in the middle of nowhere. I was like, where am I? And then you take us to the park, and it's a local American Legion field we share with the local high schools and travel ball teams and stuff. And it's pretty. It's got the sweet backdrop of the mountain in the background, but let's just say the surface is not very, very good. And the first ground ball I got, routine ground ball, bounces over my head, off like in the center. I'm like, oh my, I'm just terrified. This is horrible. One of it looks like uphill. It's got a little ditch in the middle of the thing. It was eventful. And then the locker room was like this old travel trailer. I'm pretty sure the visiting one had like a mice infestation at some point. Like it was definitely a different atmosphere coming from, you know, A&M and Olsen and private jets to away games. Now you're taking 9-10 hour bus rides and getting up the next morning and playing. It was definitely different, but fortunately had some success there, and I got called up after 10 games. I got to go to Appleton, Wisconsin, which was which is very nice. Their stadium there, that's our low A team. Great stadium, average about 6,000 fans, awesome surface. That felt like actual, you know, minor league baseball. It's pretty cool to play in front of those fans. But yeah, the lifestyle till high A, we had host families. Didn't always have a vehicle, so it's hard to get around. Bus trips, living out of hotels. Food was scarce at times. I think that first year, in 2 months, I lost 13 pounds playing minor league baseball. So you don't realize it until you literally play every day. Like, we had a stretch, we played 23 days in a row. So yeah, it's definitely different. There's no breaks. You're just like, man, I used to laugh because growing up and watching big league games, I'd see, like, I'd watch a game. I'd ask, like, so some superstar wasn't playing. My dad's like, always to get a day off. So what does he need a day off for? Like, this is baseball. It's supposed to be fun. That was the first time I was okay. Now I know why these people need days off, because it's a grind. It was definitely different, but something to adjust to. And yeah, it was fun though. It was a big eye-opening experience. It's kind of either changed the way you go about your business in terms of getting yourself ready to play with stretching and taking care of your body. It was became a big, definitely a bigger part of my pregame, I guess, routine, instead of just saying, okay, I'm young, just go play. I got a break tomorrow and kind of, you know, go with it. So it was fun. It was definitely different though, the first 2 years or so after coming from A&M.
When you get to focus on baseball 24/7, you cut the school aspect out, don't have to worry about that, don't have to worry about anything, what's going on in campus. When your job is baseball 24/7, what from your game gets noticeably better, or what can you give a little more attention to that you might not have been able to in college?
Yeah, just you get a lot more reps and everything, right? So you just fine tune everything. I think the biggest jump I made towards the middle to end of my professional career is I got a lot better defensively. Because just every day at work, taking tons of early work ground balls, working on my feet, working on my footwork. And then offensive, same thing. You kind of hone in on a routine and what you like to do every day. And you just do it every day. And you have your 30, 40 swings with how you're doing it off the tee. And then maybe some flips. And then taking your batting practice. And you just kind of really take ownership of what you do pregame and who you want to be as a player. And you kind of just, you really fine tune all those things and just playing baseball and getting those reps every single day. You don't even realize how much better you're getting while you're doing it. But looking back, like, I was like, man, I feel like I didn't improve at all 1 year, because it just kind of ups and downs of performance in the season and mentally draining. But then you look back, like, man, I was way better at this than I was last year. That came way easier. It's just the constant, I guess, reps that just noticeably, just every day, you just keep working on. Just by the end of the year, you've made monumental improvements to certain things. So I don't say anything in particular. Maybe my defense, my feet in particular, working my feet in the infield. But yeah, just over everything, really. I really took ownership of the routine. Like I said, I got to pro ball, and in college, you're always told, like, okay, we're doing this in the cage. And the first day I went to the cage in rookie ball, the hitting coach was like, all right, what do you want to do? And I was kind of like, I don't know. You tell me. Like, that's kind of how, like, you tell me. He goes, no, that's not how this works here. He goes, you need to find a routine that works for you, what you want to do every day. So that kind of was something I figured out in pro ball. I kind of, you know, took things I liked, tried things I didn't like, and it kind of worked out what I thought would help me the most, and took ownership of that routine. And I kind of figured out what I wanted to do as a hitter, what I wanted to get better at, and kind of work from there. So that's kind of, as a player, you take ownership of what you want to be, and you do it every day, and then you see the improvements on the field.
So in college, especially when you were playing kind of the last bastion of this era of, you know, teams leaving their starter in as much as possible, throwing the same guy. I mean, especially you see now in regionals, you know, you get to those fifth game, whatever, they're throwing out the guy. They have to throw out the guys who threw like three innings all year, the guys who can't throw strikes, stuff like that. So in college, they're leaving guys in a lot. Starters will go 7-8 innings, especially when you were playing. Like, coaches run their horses. In pro ball, it's a lot different. You know, even if a guy could have 5 shutout innings, he hits his pitch count, he's done. Guy, you know, they're switching out those arms a lot more. As a switch hitter, did you find, you know, does that add any sort of difficulty level, getting switched around multiple times in games and stuff like that, and having to work off different arms, not seeing a guy 3 times through a start, you know, only seeing a guy once or twice before you're then seeing your next at bats are against different dudes?
Yeah, switching sides of the plate during a game never really bothered me a whole lot, but only seeing guys once or twice was difficult. Like, you get a starter, like, after a second at bat, like, okay, I'm seeing this guy, good night, I'm on him, I got him. And then they go switch, throw some guy that throws 98 with a hammer, and you're like, okay, well, now I got to readjust my whole plan. It's got a lot harder. So it was more difficult that way, because you start formulating the plan, right, of how you're going to attack this guy. And as soon as you do that, they switch pitchers. So it's kind of tough. But on the flip side, playing series and concert series, you play the same teams for the most part a lot. So you'll have 20 games against this team. So maybe the first series, this bring the reliever, you don't know him, but by the third time you play this team and third series, like, you kind of have a book on all the relievers. So even if they switch pitchers like that, you still kind of have that idea of how he attacks you. The sort of scouting reports come into play, right? You go through your hitters meetings with what this guy throws, what he likes to do, his tendencies, and that helps a lot. So yeah, the first time seeing a guy is usually pretty tough. Once you get a book on him, kind of see him a few times over the course of a couple of series, even though they switch pitchers, which can kind of be, you know, that day, maybe you're seeing that one guy pretty good, but you have an idea of how that guy's going to attack you, and that can help, you know, kind of alleviate some of that difficulty in terms of how much they switch pitchers.
As a senior sign, as a utility guy, you're trying to make, you know, you're trying to do the same thing you did early in college, play a couple positions, make yourself useful. How much do you feel like in an organization's plans you are? Like, when you're in college, you can talk to your coach, you can talk to an assistant coach, get kind of a sense of where you're shaking out. Like, in, you know, your freshman year of college, they say, hey, you got to play better, we're going to ship you to junior college, like that sort of thing. Where do reassurances come from in pro ball?
I don't know, because I don't think I got any. So unfortunately for me, just by happenstance, I got drafted, and the GM that drafted me retired the year he drafted me, like right after, 2 months after. So then David Stearns comes in and he's not the one that drafted me. So already I'm behind the eight ball because I am not one of his guys. And so I saw that immediately in the sense of my first year, I went from rookie ball for 10 games to full season eight ball for most of the season. And the next year I come back for spring training, I am now going to high A, but I am slated to be sharing time, basically playing behind a guy that I played in front of in rookie ball. This guy skipped low A because I guess our GM, you know, had more liked him better or something. So that's the first time I'm seeing, okay, well, nothing based on performance here dictates this. So it's kind of strange. I basically was an uphill battle the whole time. That new GM kind of, I don't think I really was in his plans, but I kind of forced my way in a lot. I actually had some meetings after a couple of years in Double A where they're like, dude, because we put you in some very, I guess not very forgiving situations. We put you, you know, in some challenging spots and you keep finding a way to line up before me. He said this in a very complimentary way. Was, you're kind of a pain in the butt. Like, cause we don't know what to do with you. Cause we don't really have you in our plans. If you keep like putting yourself out there and make us have to consider you, and you're kind of, you know, you're kind of being a pain. So I don't think I ever was really in their plans in a sense. So that was, I had up about my whole minor league career in terms of having the fourth win lineups, take every advantage I could. You see the business side of things, and, you know, being a senior signed guy with not a whole lot of money invested in me, I didn't get, you know, as many opportunities as other people would who had big numbers invested in them. So it was definitely different. But I tried to take advantage of every opportunity I could and force my way in there. And it was definitely a grind, took a toll on you mentally, knowing you had to perform every chance. You know, you put a lot of pressure on yourself knowing, okay, I got like one start this week. I got to do something with it to get a chance, maybe start next week. So, it was difficult, but it was fun. And it was very challenging. It's kind of, I'm sure everyone goes through their hardships and uphill struggles, but, it's kind of been the story of my whole career in playing sports. So I embraced it as a challenge and took on the adversity and tried to make the best of it.
How does that kind of mindset that everyone has to take as far as making the most of chances? Obviously, you know, some guys get more chances than others, but just in general, especially you get to Double A when you're 24, that for most everyone on that roster, at least a lot of guys, at least guys who, you know, are going to get those chances, you have a hot month and a half and some opportunities make their way via injuries or whatever, you know, it could change your life. You're two calls away. How does that reflect in a locker room as far as team goes? It's obviously not going to be the same as, you know, one team, one goal, trying to get to Omaha, whatever. What is the vibe around a Double A clubhouse when guys are trying to get their ABs, guys are trying to get their work in, guys are just hoping to get that call versus, you know, the thing in college where everyone wants to get drafted, but you want to win first?
Yeah, it's very different. I try to explain to some people I know that are playing college, like, hey, what's minor league ball like? Like, the vibes are a lot different. It's still fun, still baseball. It's a grind with so many games. So you do a lot more quirky things, keep you loose, you know, joke around the dugout. I mean, the clubhouse, playing cards, hanging out, listening to music. But obviously we're all competitive, so we would like to win, but yeah, it's not always, you know, the top of the, like, so let's say we lose a game and so-and-so goes 4-4 with two doubles. He's not exactly in a bad mood after the loss. He's like, oh, I had a good game. So, or vice versa. Sometimes you see even where we'd win, the pitcher gives up a three spot, done with both the lead, but now his ERA took a beating. So he's like, not like physically, you could tell he's kind of annoyed though, even though we won a game, but he kind of gave up a lot of runs. So it's just a little different aspect. You kind of know that going into it. And Now, obviously, there's some issues where you get a little bit too vocal with your selfishness and sense of like, well, you know, everyone knows you're kind of looking for your stats, but you don't want to be over the top with how you, I guess, portray that after win or loss. So there was a few instances where that came up where we had to kind of like tell the guy, hey, chill out a little bit. But it is different. But I mean, it still had some team camaraderie there. You spend so much time with those guys on the buses and everything. So still a lot of good stories and fun. But yeah, the whole atmosphere was a little different. Not so much, you know, team first. It was more so we're just a bunch of dudes here chasing a dream together, hanging out, and hopefully a couple of us make it. So
after you get to the high minors, and you, like you said, you're scratching for ABs, you're trying to find playing time, you know, making yourself valuable, making yourself useful. It's kind of apparent at that point, age 25, 26, you're probably not going to be Mike Trout. For a guy in your shoes, what's the dream there? You know, when you're a kid, you dream of being a Hall of Famer or All-Star or whatever. When reality kind of resets itself when you're 25, 26, what were your dream? What did you hope for your next 5 years in baseball?
Yeah, so playing against a bunch of those guys in AA and AAA, you know, you play against a ton of people that are in the big league. Some of them are All-Stars, some of them are, you know, everyday big leaguers. So I got to the point where I was like, all right, self-awareness again. Like, I realize I'm not going to be an All-Star, but I've seen the guys that made it. Like, I know I can play in the major leagues, and I could be a very solid utility player. So help someone out on the bench, possibly. If someone gets hurt, I can fill in for an extended period of time as a starter. Like, I was pretty that said, like, I was capable of doing that. And that was kind of my vision of myself going forward. Just give me a chance, big leagues. I'll work my way into being, you know, a solid bench guy, and I'll be a guy, give you a couple spot starts, or giving the guy a day off or something. So that's kind of the role I envisioned for myself going forward there towards the later half of my professional career.
You're 2019. When did you find out that you'd be going to San Antonio?
So in spring training, they was possibly be going right out of spring training. I'd been in double A for 2 years at that point, and the manager, Rick Sweet, he's a big fan of mine. He was fighting for me hard to come to San Antonio with him. But at that point with the roster, I think we ended up signing a couple like former big leaguers that on minor league deals, like late in spring training. So that kind of bumped me out of AAA. So they sent them to San Antonio instead. And I think like Tyler Saladino, Corey Spangenberg were kind of later signs and kind of bumped me out of there. So I went to Biloxi again for the third year in a row. I was only there for like a month. Was a little annoyed about it because, you know, I felt in my mind, based on what I've done the previous 2 years, I deserved to, you know, be moved up out of that level at that point. And so I was waiting for it, and I found out that there's a couple injuries on the missions. So two guys got hurt, so they had some spots come up, and I actually got a start in Biloxi, hit a homer that day. And then the locker room, I kind of clubhouse come in, and they called me in the office, like, hey, you're going to San Antonio. So I was actually on the road in Chattanooga. All my stuff was still in Biloxi, so I flew to San Antonio, told my parents, and I was there the next day. It all happened pretty fast, so that was about a month in. And then I got a couple chances to play. Actually went to Des Moines. We on the road in Des Moines for one game. They went to San Antonio. But, yeah, so that's cool. Got to come there for a little bit. Got a couple of starts. I pinched it a lot, and then the injuries came back. That's where things got a little frustrating. I got put on the phantom DL, as they call it, quite a bit that year. So it's pretty mentally draining and frustrating year for me, though, unfortunately.
When that's happening, when you're on the phantom DL, which for, you know, it basically means you're not hurt per se, but they're just basically kind of stashing you.
Yeah.
Do you feel kind of like a captive in a sense? You have no say over it unless you can get released. Like, what? And you're in San Antonio, you're in your hometown, you're living with your parents. Like, how do you kind of process that? And how do you stay motivated when you're getting purposely stashed?
Yeah, it was, I'm not gonna lie, it was tough. That was probably the most mentally challenging year of my baseball life. That was really hard, being at home, playing for a team I grew up going to watch games of, having friends and family always say, hey, we'll come see you play. And I'm like, well, I'm not playing. It was kind of, in a way, almost like a little embarrassing. It was like, hey, I'm gonna come see you play. Like, oh, I'm gonna be coaching first base, not wearing cleats because I'm not on the roster.
And then you pinch hit when I went.
So. Yeah, so it was hit or miss. Like, some days I was like, he'd tell me the morning of, hey, you're active today. And then next day, hey, you're inactive again. Like, it was just so, I never knew it was coming. It was mentally draining. It was really hard to stay motivated. I just tried my best to be as ready as I could when I got my chance, do what I could. And then you start seeing things where even when you get your chance and perform, it doesn't really mean, it's not going to change anything. That was the most frustrating part for me. I think like my first start, I went, playing Round Rock, and I went 2-for-4 with a 3-run homer off Forrest Whitley, who was like their stud from Alma Heights. And I didn't get another at-bat for a month and a half after that. So I had a great game, which I think would earn me more playing time. But really, at that point, so many other moving parts in AAA with guys coming down from the big leagues or, you know, trades and stuff. It was a very weird year, and it was very mentally taxing on realizing you don't really have any control. So it was very hard for me because it's always been my mindset, like, give me a chance and I'll find a way to make it work. And then when that's not really an option anymore, like, it was very hard for me to process. So that was a tough year for me. I enjoyed playing at home, and playing for the Mission was an awesome story, but probably mentally, it's probably the most challenging, most difficult years I've ever had in my baseball career.
You go from that, then we have the COVID year, no minor league season, to 2021, you're in indie ball. From just a joy perspective, compare your season in Lancaster to your season in AAA, your hometown.
I had way more fun playing in Lancaster because just being able to play every day was awesome. I have not been an everyday starter for probably about 3 years at that point. So just getting to play every day was a blast. I mean, getting out in the field, and you want to finally build some rhythm at the plate, you know, getting 4 or 5 games over, just pinch it here, don't hit for a week, two pinch it. Like, it's hard to build any type of momentum at the plate. So that was awesome. And then I always told myself in my head, like, kind of certain milestones I thought I was capable of doing if I had played every day. And I was able to kind of, you know, achieve some of those things to kind of like prove myself correct. It's like, okay, I really can do that. So that was kind of fun to be a part of. And, you know, you see some former big league guys too out there. So that's a really unique environment too. Seeing some of those guys maybe tail end their career, but they're all very, very nice guys. Talk to them very, you know, and to have taken on a mentorship role with a lot of even players on other teams. So it was a cool experience around those guys and getting to continue to play baseball and enjoy the game.
With that season, you're also in building a rhythm at the plate, you're also learning the automatic strike zone. Walk me through, you know, your process when it comes to that, how you feel about that, should it be implemented at the game's highest level?
So they automated the Atlantic League strike zone that year. They based it on your height. So I tried to cheat the system a little bit and told them I was 5'8", because the height, the strike zone was going to be, the top of the zone would be 54% of your height. And the bottom of the zone is going to be like 27 or 26% of your height. But that's when you're standing straight up vertically. That doesn't take into account like your crouching, your stance or anything. So, and on top of that, the plate, the strike zone was a ball and a half off the plate each way. So it was very wide. So, and on top of that, it's like imaginary line. So if the ball just like clips the line as it's coming through, even on the outside, barely nicks it, that's a strike.
And you have a pretty bendy knees stance. If I
remember correctly. And so there's so many balls that were getting called at my letters, or like curveballs coming out of the sky that felt like it was crossing at my neck, just nicking the top of the zone, or getting called strikes, or backdoor breaking balls or strikes. And it was just, it was so difficult to kind of trust your eyes at that point, because at this point, you know, playing all the games I had in my life, I felt like I had a pretty good idea of where the strike zone was at. And then so many times, like, right out of the hand, oh, nope, ball. And then they catch it and they're calling it a strike. I was like, I was just so confused at what my eyes were telling me versus what they were calling strikes. So it made you second guess yourself a ton. And I personally didn't like it. Maybe second guess my own strike zone a ton. I chased a lot of pitches than I normally would have not chased, because I just didn't know if it was a strike or not. So it's very difficult to me. Now, if they calibrate it maybe a little smaller, maybe, I don't know, but catching the ball behind the plate too, like, you see catchers really whiff the ball, hitting all, they take their glove way out of the zone, like, and the dirt, they're calling it strike because it's irrelevance how it crosses the plate and stuff. So just the whole thing looks weird and doesn't really look like baseball, and I'm not sure a whole lot of people in our league really enjoyed it, actual baseball players. So I'm not a big fan of it, but it was definitely different, definitely something I had to learn. It was a whole new experience at the plate.
Was there a noticeable difference with the pitcher farther back? Because they implemented that as well.
Yeah. So they tried to do that, I guess, to give yourself, the hitters, more reaction time. So they wanted more contact. So hopefully make a 96-mile fastball like look like it was 92. I personally didn't notice a huge difference how slower it looked. I did notice that once they moved the mound back, though, they started throwing a lot more breaking balls because they move more. There's more time for it to move. So two-seamers and sinkers are really moving. Cutters cut an extra 3 inches. You know, just everything moved more. That's something I noticed. But overall, in terms of velocity, I didn't notice a huge difference. The pitchers I talked to said they said the same thing. They noticed a lot of their pitches, they had to start their balls in different starting points based on the breaking balls because it was moving more. And then they said the first couple starts, they were really sore, I guess extra extension for another foot or so. But after that, they said it was a huge difference. Just release points were different because they had to go farther. But that was about it. So I'm not sure that was a huge success either. But I mean, I get the idea in a sense, but I didn't know it was huge different. Just ball moved a lot more.
Well, you wrap up that season, you put up good numbers, and then as we said at the top of the episode, this is your first year out of baseball. You just what was the linchpin in finally deciding to retire? When was it time to move on?
The lifestyle, minor league ball, not getting a whole lot of money, paycheck to paycheck, always living out of a suitcase, never know where you're going to be. I put it out there, tried my best to get re-signed this year and by an affiliated club, and it just didn't really pan out with the shortened teams now. They've cut the teams, the less players, lower drafts. There's not even many spots available to get signed for, I guess, people are not already in an affiliated team. So spots were hard to come by. I kept putting it out there with my agent, but didn't get much back. And I got offered to go play indie ball again. And I was just like, I think it's time to, if I don't get it back in the affiliated ball, maybe move on and try something more stable, something I start building a career with instead of trying to chase this dream. I'm all for playing, and it's been my life goal my whole life. But I always told myself I don't want to play just to play, in a sense. And for me, I would like to play. I still see a pathway to me making it to major leagues, and I didn't really see that path anymore. So I figured it was time to move on, and now I'm trying to get my name out there and trying to put my name to some coaches I know in college. I like to get into college coaching, and hopefully that's my next career moving forward. I like to impact the game that way and still be in a competitive environment. So I guess that's the route I'm trying to go next. And it was tough. I mean, still every day I watch a game, I still miss it. I still question myself. Like, I know I can still play, but it is what it is. And it's kind of, something I had to come to grips with.
So if you could go back, give yourself a pep talk at 22, day after signing, what would that pep talk look like?
Man, just don't let the ups and downs of the business take away the fun of the game, because the business side of the minor league game can suck the fun out of the game for you if you let it. And a few times for a couple streaks or series of games or so, a couple months or so, it did. Like, I love baseball to death, and being between the lines is awesome, but there's a couple times where it did suck the joy a little bit. So just kind of let, in a sense of what they say, ride the wave, let that business side of things be that side of the things, and just play baseball and enjoy your time on the diamond. Cause I said, like, one of these days is going to come to an end. You're going to miss it. So turn 30 in a couple of weeks. So I'm fortunate to get to play professional baseball at 30 years old, but at the same time, I'm still going to miss it every day. So just kind of enjoy the game, let the other stuff be the other stuff, the outside noise, and just enjoy your time, cause it's going to be gone one day.
Quick rapid fire for you, and then I'll let you get out of here. Favorite minor league ballpark?
Oof. That's tough. There's a lot of stuff, especially Triple A. So, sneaky El Paso is an unbelievable ballpark. I loved El Paso.
I've heard incredible things.
Yeah, El Paso is actually an unbelievable ballpark. I was a big fan of El Paso. Round Rock, super nice, obviously. I'm trying to think of some lower level ones, though, that are good. Jacksonville is a great one, too, actually, in Double A. I love Jacksonville. So, I would say probably Jacksonville, El Paso, Round Rock, Oklahoma City is nice. So, yeah, a lot of those are good.
Favorite away SEC ballpark?
Oof. So, I got two. Coolest atmosphere and unique is Mississippi State. It was awesome. Before they renovated it, so they had, like, basically call, the left field lounge out there with all, like, the misfit, stations that they built, which is awesome. They were cooking barbecue. They gave us barbecue after the last game. That was an awesome experience. Second one, also kind of personal, because my grandpa went to LSU. My family's Cajun, but I love playing at LSU with Alex Box. It was an awesome environment, seeing all that, especially when we played them. That was 1-2. So that was really cool. I got a lot of my extended family to come to that game. So I would say LSU and Mississippi State.
Your junior and senior year postseasons. Junior year, regional game against Texas, but in Houston. And senior year, super regional against TCU in Lupton. Which crowd was wilder?
Probably TCU and Lupton. That game was just way more insane. I mean, the Texas one, we were running on fumes at that point coming back, and we played our butts off to get to that point. But, might make some Texas fans angry here, but Texas fans really are never that rowdy to me. I mean, we played in front of them, we have that huge rivalry, and it's tough, but they never get super, super loud, super rowdy. They don't talk a lot of mess or anything. So, I love playing Texas. It's fun. It's a good environment. But TCU, they're on the level, man. They're kind of, they were a little chirpy. They were talking. That game just was meant more going to Omaha. That lasted long, so I'm sure there was a few adult juice boxes being drank for a while. So they're pretty chirpy. That was a pretty good environment. That was pretty fun. It's pretty intense.
Best pitcher you ever faced?
Oof, man. In college or professional?
You call it. Who's the best guy? You step in the box, who gave you the most trouble?
That's tough. Well, I faced Walker Buehler at Vanderbilt. He was pretty nasty. I'm trying to think. I can't remember this dude's name. I don't know how I remember his name, but I remember he came in. He was in Double A. He was throwing 100 miles an hour, but he came in through 8 straight sliders. Every slider was 93 miles an hour. It was the nastiest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. But for some reason, I cannot remember his name. So I'll go with him, whoever he is, unnamed pitcher who's disgusting.
Unnamed guy.
And then I'm trying to think of the face this kid in AAA. Same thing. Name is Dylan Maples for the Cubs.
Oh, yeah.
Dude had the nastiest slider I've ever seen in my entire life. Could not see it. It moved 4 feet and it was 92 miles an hour. So, yeah, he was – and I had to pinch off him. So, come up the bench cold. That was not fun either. So, those are some guys. There's too many to name, honestly. There's so many good guys I just go on the list. But, yeah, there's I've faced a lot of good pitchers. That was pretty awesome. Yeah, it was just pretty awesome. You watch TV now. You watch a big league game. Like, oh, face that guy. No, like, it's just really cool to see all those guys having so much success and, you know, saying you were in the box with those guys. It's pretty cool. There's so many of them to name.
Last question. Everyone gets this one. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
Oh, man. Probably a few. I don't know. I can't sleep on buses. I don't know why I can't. So many nightmare. Like,
you wait. Picked a tough career to not be able to sleep
on
buses.
Yeah, I know. I did. And so, you get done with the game at, 9:30, 10 o'clock. You have an all-nighter, 12 hours. You got a game the next day. Double A one time, we played a home game in Biloxi. Finished at – started at 6:30, finished about 11. We left on the road about midnight. We drove to Jacksonville, which is about an eight-hour bus ride. Rolled into Jacksonville about 8:39. We had a day and a game at 3 Sunday. We had to be back at the stadium at noon. So we basically bussed a whole day, had 3 hours until we'd be at the field again for the next game. And our rooms weren't ready. And so we had to sleep in the lobby or like in a little makeshift, whatever, dining hall or whatever it is, or conference room. So I slept on the floor there for 2.5 hours. Didn't sleep all night, but I can't sleep on buses. And I go play a game that day in Jacksonville in July. So super hot. So that was pretty miserable.
That is, it's amazing how many we have had like that of long night, rooms aren't ready, sleeping in a dining room, game that day. That is as minor leagues as it gets. Blake Alemán, that is all I've got for you. Congratulations on a career well played. Thanks for coming on from Phenom to the Farm.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. It's awesome.
You got it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.